I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Mental health care is tough to navigate. Amid the shortage of providers, intake beds, and wait lists, are patients struggling to be seen? And for those in some groups, be seen by a provider they can relate to. Today, how the lack of diversity in mental health care professionals means some patients in need are going without service. Hear how equity in mental health care is affecting Kansas City's marginalized communities. Then, our smart money experts have tips on benefiting from today's booming economy. Learn why now might be a good time to request a promotion or make an industry move to a position that increases your human capital. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Marginalized communities continue to struggle to get the mental health care that they need. The problem isn't just in Kansas City, it remains a nationwide concern. Just because the health care professionals and services exist doesn't mean the opportunities for accessing them are the same for all people. Among the issues are provider shortages, lack of inpatient treatment beds, and providers who lack cultural sensitivity. All are factors contributing to this shortage. The result, 56% of American adults with mental illness do not receive the treatment they need. One in five adults report an unmet need. Now a conversation about the scale of the problem and what can be done about it. With us, Caroline Gibbs is director at Transgender Institute Kansas City. Caroline, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Jay Bennett is the founder of Street Medicine KC that works to achieve higher levels of care. Jay, nice to have you.
Good morning.
So the bottom line here, Caroline, is that lots of people in this country need mental health care, and they can't get it. That's the issue we're talking about here, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's the exact issue we're talking about. And this issue disproportionately affects transgender women of color. And this is what our organization focuses on and has for 20 years. Hmm. Their needs are quite different in the mental health arena and in all the parts of their lives.
I imagine for both of you watching all this unfold, Jay, this has got to be heartbreaking at times.
It is. For us, we primarily work with those that are on the streets or rough sleepers in shelters, living in encampments.
You call them rough sleepers?
Rough sleepers.
What does that mean?
Every few years, it seems that we get a little better PC with saying instead of homelessness, they're rough sleepers, so they're actually sleeping roughly outside.
Hmm.
So more the terms are popping up on the East Coast and the West Coast about being called rough sleepers rather than the homeless population.
How about you, Caroline, when it comes to how emotional, how difficult this can be to watch these people not get the care they need?
It's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I so much wish, and this is probably a wish, that not only those among us who go out onto the streets and help those in need directly as individuals and small organizations, but that a large philanthropic organization would take this cause under their wings.
Hmm. You've made the request, I imagine, and haven't gotten the response you're looking for.
I'm talking to an organization right now, very, very large church, which has shown some initial interest.
Okay. How aware is the healthcare community, Jay, that there's a big problem here?
Well, for instance, very, very aware. My background in healthcare, as well as the organizations and hospitals that deal and have intakes from individuals that are homeless, that are dealing with different mental health issues and or substance abuse issues, are quite aware of it. And we understand the impact that that makes not only on their system, but also, which you mentioned earlier, the cultural competence of dealing with these individuals that are actually homeless, dealing with that trauma.
And what that means is that sometimes therapists, doctors aren't trained, aren't sensitive enough to the needs of gay and transgender individuals?
Correct. And we were speaking a little earlier offline is that, you know, the data shows that African Americans are 6 to 8 to 1 more liable to be homeless than their white counterparts. Veterans are 10 to 1. Transgender, we're looking at 14 to 15 to 1.
Hmm.
So the comment we make on the streets is if you're transgender, a veteran, and black, and homeless, you're screwed.
Hmm. Well, hopefully, this is a side comment, the veterans issue has been is being dealt with through what programs we've talked about on this show, yep. Tiny homes and that kind of thing, right?
Right. VCB is doing some good work, but there's still 127 veterans in our community right now that are under our VAT system for rapid placement of housing right now that are seeking housing. VCP has done a good job, but there needs to be a lot more. Like we were saying offline earlier, is that it takes organizations to come together to show a little humility, not be so many in silos to actually get something done. This past Wednesday, the oldest person that we know that's been on the streets for about 25, 26 years, we housed her this Wednesday. But that took Truman. Hmm. That took the Greater Kansas Coalition and Street Medicine KC and Kansas Medical Center all together working to get this person housing.
So again, you're saying there are still dozens of homeless veterans out on the streets of Kansas City as we sit here today.
Or in transitional placing or in shelters, correct.
Yeah. Caroline, how would you describe the problem in Kansas City as we bore down here to what's happening in our neck of the woods? How would you describe it?
If we talk about those people who are disadvantaged, I'm not sure whether you would like to focus, Steve, just on the disadvantaged today. But I would say that transgender people as a whole have a myriad of issues that they have to deal with, quite apart from those people who are disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. So trans women of color face way more issues than someone who may have gender dysphoria, but have the resources to get the help.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about them in just a couple of minutes here. How would you describe the scale of the problem in Kansas City, Jay?
Oh, wow. I couldn't measure it. I can tell you that if there were five more organizations like ourselves, if there were two more Truman ACOs with their 500 housing, every organization, if we doubled it, still wouldn't be enough. Let's just put that in scope. Wow. Every organization out there, if we doubled our efforts, it still wouldn't be in scope, especially when it comes to mental health.
And the main issue there is what? Lack of providers, cultural sensitivity? What is it?
A combination of both of those. So it's yes and yes. And then as we move closer to understanding that, you know, mental health is physical health first, right? Then we'll do a paradigm shift to actually focus more on that. 68% of everyone on the streets right now has been diagnosed with four different mental health issues, not substance abuse. So imagine that was medical. There'd be a catastrophe, right?
Right.
There isn't.
You're saying 68%. Any sense of the problem? Is the problem getting better or worse, Caroline?
As bias in society, since I started doing this 20 years ago, there's been a shift in the level of bias as education and the publicity, the media, has come out with more understanding of this issue. We are certainly improved. But I must say that underneath this administration, trans people are running scared.
Under the Trump administration you're talking about.
Yes.
Because, maybe it's obvious, but because why?
The evangelical Christian organization seems to be, according to my resources, pushing the Trump administration to throw out, as it were, the transgender, LGBT, specifically transgender population.
Meaning not provide that group any care whatsoever.
Marginalize them more than they've ever been marginalized before.
Jay, you're nodding your head as Caroline's saying that.
Yeah, totally agreeing with her on that.
Yeah. And how's that manifesting itself out in the streets? Are people more fearful to get care because of what they're sensing out of Washington?
I'm going to say a little bit of yes, and that goes to Medicaid and Medicare and CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. A lot of issues dealing with that, with housing and the housing first issue. And so, you know, for us, from our lens, is that our individuals that need to be housed first, and then what's second? So if housing's first, what's second? So that supportive housing is actually engaging on providing mental health services for transgender, for LGBTQ, for whomever it may be.
How difficult is it for anybody, for that matter, to navigate the mental health system in our community? Because I hear from people, you know, with some regularity that it is really tough.
It is tough.
Figure out where to go and the kind of help you need and find the right therapist, all those things.
Right. And that's where the Transgender Institute and organizations like ours come in. Because, Steve, we are comprehensive. So if they enter our doors,
you can get them to the help they need.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's what makes you so unique in the community then.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can get them hooked up with endocrinologists, with psychiatrists if needs be. We can hook them up with people who work on aesthetics, vocal training, feminization, vocal mm-hmm. training. We can get them to support groups. We can get them to the people that they need to move on with their lives in a fruitful way.
Hmm. Tough to navigate the system, though. No question about it.
It really is. And so one of the things that we've done or more looked at is more what we call concierge medicine. For the rich, we know what that means, right? We pay extra money. So for us, we kind of use the concierge medicine model around our people that we deal with. And it's going basically to what she was saying here about being comprehensive. So, you know, for us, it's an IDP model or multidisciplinary issue. So there will be a physician or a nurse practitioner. There'll be a social worker, mental health therapist, and there'll be a community health worker along with each individual going down. Mm-hmm. So all three we know that are going to need those issues moving forward to help navigate the healthcare system.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about marginalized communities struggling to access mental health care in our community. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Well, let's talk about some of the reasons why some members of our community struggle to access the care they need. How about one obvious concern would be the number of mental health providers that are out there. Is that number adequate? And as you sense society becoming more open to the idea that people might need more mental health care than they previously thought, is that putting a strain on the system in terms of the number of providers out there for transgender folks or for anybody for that matter?
In Kansas City, we are woefully short on practitioners and hospitals that are completely trained to deal with in specific transgender folks.
How big of an issue is that?
It's a huge issue.
Yeah.
Just last month, I had a client walk into, unbeknownst to me, walk into a primary care clinic. It was told, this happened to be a female to male, a trans man, walked in and was told, "We do not treat your kind."
Hmm. How did that person react to that?
Completely traumatized.
I bet.
Yes.
Yeah. What are you sensing when it comes to shortage of providers out there, Jay?
It's been going on since 1982.
This is nothing new.
That's nothing new. And under the Reagan administration, you know, back in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s, we had these insane asylums, right? And they were horrible places. But we had places to place people that were schizophrenic, et cetera, on the streets. And so, you know, the funding from 1982 to now has not changed. The same number. Right. So same amount of numbers. So we cut back on providing mental health and looking at mental health, schizophrenia, what case may be else, but it's all mental health as a whole. So moving forward to today, we still lack a lot of mental health. But over the last 5-6 years, we are moving forward. Right. There's a lot of, because of the war, the long war, a lot of PTS coming back, a lot of notification and social media going around. Hey, we have a soldier dying every day. Right. Suicide, etc. So there is more coming, but there's no reason for us to rest our laurels and saying, hey, we've done enough. We have a lot more to do.
How about the number of inpatient treatment beds out there?
Not enough.
Nowhere close.
Nowhere close.
Mm-hmm. No. And that's a problem, too.
That is a problem.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi. My question for your guest is, do you ever encounter people who are living on the street who are so accustomed to it and so wary of authority that they prefer not to be housed? And if that's the case, what do you do with those people? I'll take your answer off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, Frank. Jay?
Yeah, so I'll answer that. I run into that every day. Well, not every day, like 3 times a week. And some of the, when I first asked about it, it was this. Why try to get a job making $7 an hour and having to work, you know, 80 or 90 hours a week just to basically stay poor by getting an apartment? so they'd rather stay in the streets. So that's one. Secondly, when we're dealing with, you know, 68% of individuals out there with that's been diagnosed with mental health issues, you don't lack the capacity to actually maintain or keep a job or even keep health relationships. So that's the second part. And so for those that want to stay out there, it's not about saying, hey, everyone needs to be housed. How are we addressing their needs, right? Do we want everyone housed? Ideally, yes, that'd be great. But for those that have given up, those are some of the reasons for it. I mean, because if you think about it, most people I say are two flat tires away from being, you know, homeless. So if you only have one spare in a car.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's also this notion of there's a lack of inpatient treatment beds. You just talked about that. How about the quality hospitals provide quality treatment? Maybe it goes, you just in answer to that in the last question, but that's also an issue, right?
It is an issue.
Yeah.
Something so simple as what do I call someone, a transgender person, when they come in the hospital for care?
Mm-hmm.
And we've done a lot of training in that regard, but a whole lot more needs to be done. Do you say, which name would you like me to use? Yes, that's what you should say.
Mm-hmm.
Do you say, which pronouns would you prefer? Yes. The paperwork needs to reflect that. So if those basic things aren't happening, you're nowhere.
So the two of you are describing a mental health treatment system in this community that is woefully inadequate. Am I hearing that right, Jay?
I'm not going to say inadequate. I'm going to say it's lacking resources.
Lacking resources.
I can say that from our lens, from the streets, is that our hospitals are doing the best they can. But remember, healthcare is three things, three Ps, the patient, the provider, and the payer. And the payer dictates what goes on. So for someone coming to Signor Psychiatric Hospital or St. Luke's Hospital, that person without insurance will have a bed for a short period of time until someone who does have insurance will take that bed. That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just business, right? I understand that. So we need to find a way where, for instance, to get Medicaid for all, or Medicare for all, or some type of insurance where we're able to really stay around an individual's more than 7 days in the hospital or 2 or 3 days in the hospital and kick them out.
Hey, isn't the KU Med Center adding a new psychiatric unit?
And oh, yeah.
Is that going to change the math in town very much, or how would you describe that?
It is changing the math in the town.
Is it online yet? Or
it is, and I just met with them last week, and we're meeting again next week.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're a great organization over there. Rainbow Service as well with Wyandotte, Inc., with Dr. Lohr, who is going to be here today with me, but unfortunately he had some other issues, couldn't show up. So, we're making a dent, but there's a lot more to me be done, and I want to make sure that we understand that no matter what we do moving forward, we need to keep on moving forward on it.
Mm-hmm. Why is there such a lack of providers who are culturally sensitive, Caroline, in a city that's a fairly diverse city? How can those two things jive?
It's my belief that at heart, Steve, these folks are biased. You cannot live in this culture, myself included, trans people included, without being biased against trans people.
Mm-hmm.
We call it internalized transphobia for transgender folks.
Yeah. Let's talk about the group that you've already described as having the biggest struggles here, transgender women of color. Let's go back. How big of a struggle are they facing out there, Caroline?
They have to be sex workers or not make it. They're homeless.
Meaning what? What do you mean by that?
They have to be on the streets providing sex for money in order to live.
Mm-hmm. And because they can't work elsewhere? What are you suggesting?
They oftentimes have lost their jobs. They oftentimes are born and grow up in very disadvantaged situations to start with. That would be the primary thing. And the bias in our culture, they're thrown out of their jobs. They can't get a job at all.
Because job protections aren't in place for folks like that.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's hard to hear. That's a mouthful what you just said.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. This group has been described as the most marginalized community. Do I have that right?
You do.
Yeah. Would you say that they need these services the most then? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. What about being able to establish trust with providers? How much more difficult is that for a marginalized person?
I think it is more difficult, but I think the other half of it is that the provider has to be trained, loving, be able to establish a rapport for somebody that's running scared.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't do those basics just as a basic therapist, then you shouldn't be doing this work.
Are you seeing doctors, therapists, and the like getting that kind of training to do the jobs you think they need to do?
Not enough. Mm-hmm. We've done quite a bit of it. My thought now is to provide a certificate course through our organization to allow these people to learn, to drop their bias, to move on with knowledge and education.
And you're talking about the Transgender Institute in Kansas City,
yes,
actually doing a certificate process.
Right.
Are hospitals and doctors and therapists open to that idea?
They would certainly be.
Yeah. Let's go back to some phone calls here. And Mary from Kansas City, Missouri. Mary, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. My comment is that I know parity with mental health and physical health was legislated about 10 years ago. But it was given to the states to enforce that mental health would get the same amount of funding as physical health. And that's in Missouri, that has been very, very poorly enforced. And therefore, it's very hard as clinicians to set up a practice because we can't get paid by insurance.
Well, Mary, you can read the future, because that was my next question here. Missouri remaining one of only two states, we've done shows on this, that has not enforced the 2008 Mental Health Parity and Addictions Equity Act. How big of a problem is that, Jay?
I mean, Steve, I can run down many rabbit holes with that one there. So,
but it's, how big of an issue is it?
It's the biggest issue.
And
it's the biggest issue.
Lawmakers aren't hearing your pleas here.
They're not hearing it because they're not aware of it. Right. I believe our lawmakers that are locally and federal, if we bring it to their attention, right, and make it a key point of like, hey, look, we need to address our mental health community, our mental health community and people that are striving from these issues. Right. I think if we address it to them, they'll make a change on it.
But 48 other states have already figured this out. So what's the issue here in Missouri?
I have no idea.
You'd like to know.
Yeah.
Caroline, what's your theory?
Conservatism.
Mm-hmm. People just not being open to that idea.
Correct.
Yeah. Mary, any other thoughts you have on this and what needs to change?
Call your legislatures.
Yes.
The people in the House and the Missouri Senate, they need to know.
Hmm. I'm glad you brought that up, Mary. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
You know, we talked on this program before about the whole stigma of healthcare that appears to be gradually dissipating. I'm talking about our culture as a whole. Are you seeing that too, Caroline?
Within the transgender population, as more and more practitioners get more information, it's definitely reduced or enhanced the number of people that can get real care. We, though, need to do so much more. And that's why we were talking about developing our certificate program.
Mm-hmm.
So that people are properly trained to deal with this population.
Hey, how big of a population in Kansas City are we talking about here? Are we talking about dozens or hundreds, or what are we looking at?
The latest stats about how many transgender people there are worldwide, across geography, across time, and this is way low, we know that, 1.2% of the population is transgender.
So you're looking at thousands, perhaps, here
thousands.
In Kansas City.
Thousands of people.
Does that sound right to you, Jay?
I don't know that data, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't say that it's far off.
Okay. Well, interesting conversation, painful conversation to hear about the work that needs to be done with this group of people in particular. I want to thank Caroline Gibbs, director of the Transgender Institute, Kansas City. Jay Bennett, founder of Street Medicine KC. Appreciate you both, your comments. Good luck with your work.
Steve,
come back and
you.
See us.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Appreciate it. After a short break, when we come back, we'll talk about why right now might be a good time to ask your boss for a raise. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Mondays can be rough, but I've got just a thing to make them more fun. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. You'll get information about the shows you may have missed and a weekly column from yours truly. Sign up today, kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, we'll meet an award-winning jazz vocalist set to kick off the Folly Theater Jazz Series this weekend. Stacey Kent will tell us what's next for her after a recent world tour. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, another month, another big surge in jobs in America. Non-farm payrolls grew by 225,000 people in January, once again well above Wall Street estimates. Bottom line, it's a great time to be a worker in the U.S. economy. Unemployment remains at generationally low numbers, and businesses are having a difficult time finding talent. But how can workers take advantage of that? Manage your career is an important part of your overall financial plan. Now, a conversation about the steps an employee can take if they want to explore their career options and grow their human capital. Our Smart Money team is with us. They are Lucas Butchell, is Director of Investment Management for Aspire Wealth Partners. Lucas, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Barbara McMahon is here. She's president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Barbara, good morning.
Good morning.
Nolan Keim is with Client Service Associates at Mariner Wealth Advisors in Overland Park. Nolan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
And just a quick note to listeners, this information presented by our guests is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as a recommendation or advice related to your personal situations. Well, let's talk about current events, and as we always do to kick off these segments. Lucas, I guess as I just pointed out, the job market is hot. Hot and hotter, right?
It really is. And it's kind of amazing that it keeps posting strong numbers, even though we've been at what most economists would say full employment for a couple of years now. So the economy continues to generate jobs. And what you're seeing is now more people that have been on the sidelines and hadn't been looking for a job are now jumping in and taking advantage of opportunities.
You know, the pop in January, as I mentioned, 225,000 people, that exceeded analysts, experts going into the release of those figures, right?
Yes, and analysts are kind of confounded by that, and it really is because more people are jumping back in. So whether that's somebody that retired or maybe somebody that left the workforce, and those are a little harder to get a hold on in terms of projections.
Barbara, maybe a point that's apropos to our discussion today, full employment doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's happy with the jobs they've got, right?
That's true. It's the other side of the coin. Although there are plenty of jobs and lots of employers looking, it doesn't mean that the people who have the jobs currently are necessarily where they want to be. Some people had to settle, if you don't mind using that word, after the Great Recession, and they're just not really pleased about where they are either in their own career or at the company that they work for.
So, Nolan, what is the unemployment rate today? Where are we?
Yeah, right now it's reached a 50-year low at 3.5%.
Man.
And yeah, as you said, 225,000 jobs. I mean, that's a great sign for the economy and a great way to start 2020.
Okay, let's turn to our main topic today, which is managing your career and these opportunities that might be available in a full employment economy. Lucas, to what extent do workers these days have more leverage and opportunity because they do, right?
They do. So there's more job openings than there are workers to fill them, people that are looking. So what that tells you is there's a mismatch in skills. But outside of that, I mean, employers consistently in surveys are saying we're having a hard time finding good workers to fill positions that are available, which limits growth in those companies. But as a worker, if you're unhappy or you're just interested in making a change, now's a great time to pursue that.
Why aren't we, given all that, Barbara, why aren't we seeing those stats that show that personal income is rising more quickly than it is? Because you just haven't seen that number reflected in what we're talking about here yet. If workers have all this leverage, why aren't they making a lot more money?
That's a really good question, and it's one that economists are analyzing. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the economy has moved from a manufacturing, you know, high-paid, high-skilled manufacturing jobs to service industry, and service jobs simply don't demand the wages. I mean, we've seen this occur in Kansas City, McDonald's workers, just picketing for $15 an hour jobs. And it's because those kinds of jobs are easily filled. And there are plenty of people who have those kind of entry-level skills. So what needs to happen in the economy is They need to be paid more. We have no inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's really – that's a factor too. If you don't have inflation, there's no need to pay your employees more because their buying power has remained the same. So you've got a couple things working on.
Maybe one of the factors here, Nolan, is that a lot of workers just don't realize yet how much clout they've got.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one thing to note too, Steve, is you have to know what your value is as an employee. And it's time to be picky. And if your value is at a spot where, you know, it might be hard to replace you on the employer's end, know that. Know the facts and know that you have the leverage.
Huh, interesting. Well, let's talk about what employees can do here. And I guess one thing is to consider their current career paths here and current career plans. Lucas, what is a career plan?
A career plan is really thinking forward about the role you have, but also the job or the responsibility that you want. So how are you going to get from where you're at today to where you want to be in the future? Most people want to grow in their career in terms of responsibility, income, and opportunity. And so like many things in life, if you don't have goals, if you don't have a plan for that, it's probably not just going to happen for you. So a career plan really is a sitting down and thinking through what is it that you want, and then what are the steps that are necessary to get there, and then starting to attack those one at a time.
So maybe, Barbara, one thing that workers have to do is sit down, take a hard look at themselves, and figure out when was the last time they were promoted, when was the last time they got a new raise, when was the last time they took on new responsibilities.
I think that's absolutely true. And in addition to that, you have to ask yourself, am I happy where I am? So if you are working someplace you want to, but you're not moving ahead fast enough, you need to, as Nolan says, find your value to the firm. And what's really useful there is if you have someone else who can be an advocate for you, mm-hmm. or a mentor, help you grow, maybe help you identify the positions above you for which you would be qualified, or if you aren't, help you get those skills that you need to move ahead.
And maybe that means, Nolan, sitting down and having a conversation with your supervisors about sort of where you're at and where you want to be.
I think that's a first step, honestly. And for some, that might be a scary conversation to have. But if you can be as honest as possible and just know and let them know that you have these goals and you want to get to this spot, what is it going to take to get there? Some firms, some companies might not be able to offer that, you know, for you. And that might be the time where you start looking elsewhere. You have the leverage.
You know, having those frank conversations, that's really hard to do, as you just pointed out. And I'm wondering, why is that? Because in theory, if you're working for a good employer, it shouldn't be that tough.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. And one thing that I love about my job is I'm on a team that we're open with each other, and everyone knows exactly each other's goals and what it's going to take to get there. So, again, it can be scary, but I think once you take that step, most people will be very open to that conversation.
The other thing to wonder about, Lucas, a little bit is this idea of salary and what you're making. And the culture in America today and for so many years has been that is top secret information. You don't know what your colleagues are making. You don't know what your coworkers are making. And that makes sort of figuring out what your place is all that much more difficult.
Yes. Although some things are changing now, there's websites online that you can go to kind of do a little bit of market research. And then they've gotten better about boiling it down by region. So it used to be you could go get a national average, which, you know, may not be relevant in Kansas City, right, if there's things included, you know, in San Francisco or New York. But trying to find out what you're worth here makes sense. And that also, yeah, you can find that out by having conversations, not with just people at your company, but colleagues or professionals that are in the same or similar industry at different firms. People are a little bit more willing to share about compensation if it's not at your company. Mm-hmm. And so finding those networking opportunities with other professionals, not at your company, but in the same industry, is a good way to do that.
Do we have any stats, Barbara? Ever seen anything that would talk about how often people do ask for raises? And again, that's a really tense moment in anybody's life when that happens. But how often does it happen? Do we know?
I have not seen statistics like that.
I wonder if that's even kept.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything direct there, although you know, I think as an employer, you know, they probably want to have that conversation as little as possible, right? Because then they don't have to have that uncomfortable conversation. And workers feel like they have to display value in there. And that really is the key in that conversation, is going in, being able to highlight your accomplishments and responsibility, not complaining about your pay, but advocating for yourself. And most employers, I think, receive that okay. And the anxiety that people have is probably overstated, I think.
It's an interesting thing he just said, Barbara Lucas did, about not complaining about your pay when you walk in to ask for a raise, but being proactive and looking ahead. Your employer doesn't want to hear you bellyache about what you're making, but you get the sense they're more receptive when you make a case about what you're worth and what your goals are going forward.
I think that's true. What you need to do is stress your importance to the company, how you plan to advance with the company, and how the company will advance with you. I mean, it's a dual thing. That is what they want, something of value from their investment. And so they want to know, if I give you this raise, what's in it for me? How does that help my company? And so I think those discussions are important, but I think you have to lay out a case. If you walk in with a sense of entitlement, you're going to walk out with nothing.
Yeah, then you're really asking for it.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you guys are suggesting that these conversations aren't having as often as they need to happen.
No, I don't think so at all. But, I mean, again, if you have that plan in place, like Luke was saying earlier, if you have those goals in mind and go in with that mindset rather than, you know, I deserve this, I deserve that, I think that's a much easier conversation to have. Just laying out, you know, where you want to be in, you know, 3-5 years from now, and taking it on that approach rather than, you know, I deserve this.
Well, why is it that pay information is so tightly held? Why is it top secret?
Well, from an employer's perspective, it helps keep people content.
Well, I was going to say.
Because if you know that you're doing a similar job than somebody else there, and they're making, you know, $10,000, $15,000 more than you, that immediately makes an unhappy employee. And so, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into pay. And, you know, employers don't want that out there. And so that they kind of create a culture where that's uncomfortable. And they really try to keep that close to the vest.
So workers, in a sense, are playing along with a system that doesn't necessarily benefit them. That's your point here.
That's my point. And also, you know, workers, you know, it's always there's a bit of taboo. I mean, there always is with how much people make, and not even with coworkers, right? I mean, some people with family, you know, it's a little uncomfortable just to broadcast how much money you make. And so that's, you know, finance in general, that plays a part, but especially at work, where you can have relationships change just because of the dynamics of how much somebody gets paid.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about the advantages that workers have in today's economy, this full employment economy that we're all enjoying right now. If you have questions for our smart money experts, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Well, Barbara, pay is what we've been talking about here, but that isn't the only compensation that workers enjoy. There's also this whole area of benefits. How does that play into all of this?
That's really important. I think we work with a lot of people where perhaps one person in a couple brings the benefits home while the other makes the pay. So the benefits are critical. It's useful if you have a spouse who can provide benefits. It might allow one person perhaps a little more freedom in the amount of pay that they're willing to settle for. But things like health insurance is the one thing I'm thinking about. Mm-hmm. Health insurance is critical. The state of health insurance in this country is confusing at best. I'll just say it that way.
At best.
So a good health insurance program is important. Retirement contributions. Does the employer offer a 401k or something similar? Can you put money in? Do they match it? Do they have a profit sharing plan? Those are things you can't overlook, because that has an opportunity to increase your overall compensation, but it doesn't count as salary. Hmm. And I think people overlook that. They look at the salary and they say, is that all? And no, it's not all. It's health insurance that matters. It's retirement accounts that matters. Do you get vacation time? We've talked about that on this program before. Mm-hmm. Can you negotiate more than 2 weeks if you have many, many years of experience that you're bringing to an employer?
Yeah.
Those things, the intangibles, are important too. there's an estimate that says roughly 33% of the value of your total compensation package is probably benefits.
So obviously a huge chunk.
Oh, it's huge, yes.
And your point is that so oftentimes that chunk is overlooked in the whole negotiation process.
I think all of us have probably counseled clients to say, well, yeah, that's an okay salary, and I know you're a little disappointed, but can we look at the other things that you're getting here? Let me make some help put this in perspective for you.
You know, it seems to me that employers would find something like vacation time, there's some flexibility there. That's an easy thing to work with. But do they have much flexibility when it comes to health care or additional, you know, 401k benefit help, that kind of thing?
My inclination would be to say no, because healthcare is challenging. And
you can't give one employee one benefit compared to everybody else in the firm.
Correct. And with 401ks, with retirement accounts, there are rules that have to be met and there are laws that have to be met. So there's not a great deal of flexibility beyond I have this plan and I will match this amount for you.
Well, then there's the whole non-financial aspect of all this, Nolan, this idea of are you doing meaningful work? Is it fulfilling work? Because if that's not the case, then maybe you really got to think hard about what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, 40 plus hours a week at a job is a lot. And that's your life. And you have to enjoy what you're doing each and every day or you're not going to, you know, be happy. Going back to that recent statistic that Barbara was sharing on earlier, I mean, not all employed people are happy. So you need to find a place that, you know, are where you want to be and that you can wake up every day knowing that, you know, you're happy.
Is that purely a gut call, whether your work is meaningful or not, or is there some way to measure that?
I would say for me, it's a gut call.
Yeah, it would be for me too.
I think, you know, people that I work with, they're friends first, and that's a huge reason why I enjoy where I'm at, is because I can, you know, honestly enjoy, you know, being around the people I'm working with.
So what Nolan is saying is that Mariner Wealth Advisors in Overland Park is a great place to be.
I would say so.
that's where we're going here. That's just amazing. You hear that mid-career people often start to ask themselves these questions in their 40s. But, you know, millennials and younger people seem to be asking these questions even earlier. Nolan, am I right about that?
Yeah. I mean, I have fellow friends and graduates that I graduated with me, you know, a couple years back that have already switched jobs a couple times. And that's something that, you know, employers are more aware of now, I think, that people are changing careers more often. You're not staying at the same firm or company, you know, your entire career.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'd say is definitely on people's minds.
Okay, if you want to take some action here on your current situation, let's walk through again some things to think about here, Lucas. Consider approaching your current company. Maybe that's number one here. Mm-hmm. What should people be thinking about?
So the first thing is so if you have you want a different role or you're just looking for more compensation, being willing to go in and have that conversation. And we talked a little bit about it earlier. Come in and highlight, you know, the accomplishments that you have, the areas or projects you've contributed on.
Be upbeat and don't go negative here. This is not the time to go negative.
Exactly. Again, you're trying to make the case for it, but it's if you come across as whining, it's not going to be received well. So try to have the conversation at the current place if you're interested in staying. If you're not, then that's where you kind of look outside and start that process.
How about if you want to move to a new job or a new firm, Barbara? What do you think about there?
Well, the first thing is to make sure your resume is current. And I would also add, make sure your network is intact, that your LinkedIn profile reflects the people that you know and that you can reach out for.
And LinkedIn's really the place now where that serious job hunting, job searching, that's where that takes place.
Well, and one of the things that I've realized among working with people of different ages is that if you are older, you will tend to rely on that network more. If you are younger, you're more likely to hop onto one of the job seeker websites.
That's
and find something. I'm kind of looking over at my colleagues to see if their experience matches mine, but that's what I've noticed.
Yeah.
And LinkedIn is critical for those networks.
Even before you apply for a job, Nolan, this idea of setting up meetings, going to meet with folks who work for the company where you want to be, that might be something to think about too.
Absolutely.
What's the advantage of that?
I mean, find someone who you know you want to be. Find someone that's in a position that you want to be in, and ask them for a cup of coffee. I mean, most people won't say no to a free cup of coffee, and then just go pick their brain, you know, have questions prepared, you know what you want to get out of that meeting. But that's a great opportunity just to see, you know, are they enjoying what they're doing?
I would guess that a lot of times that doesn't happen nearly as often as it should either.
Yeah, I think people, again, it's that scary conversation. It's that next step, and I think, you know, people often shy away from it.
You know, one thing to add to that is having those conversations with folks not at your current employer do allow you to uncover some opportunities that may not be posted that you may not find on the company's website, right? So if you're talking to somebody that says, oh, yeah, we've got a new addition to the team that we're going to need to make in the next 6 months, let me go talk to somebody. You sound like you might be a good fit. So it kind of gets you plugged into that informal, you know, kind of behind the wall network. And again, so having that conversation, being willing to have those networking meetings and discussion as a way to get plugged into that world.
Barbara?
And I would say for people first entering the job market, I'm having coffee this week with a student, and we were matched up by somebody in the guidance area of the college.
Yeah.
And basically she's going to talk to me about opportunities in financial services, try to figure out if it's something she's even interested in and what she needs to do to further her career by taking appropriate courses.
Well, good for her for taking that step.
I'm
just
impressed.
Astonished as a professor at UMKC sometimes how rarely those kinds of conversations take place. A student's coming in and asking about what a career in journalism or career in whatever actually looks like. And boy, here I am sitting. I offer it to them, and you just don't see them take advantage of that all that often.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'll probably buy.
Because you feel for them, right?
Yeah.
How about people in their 50s and 60s? Nolan, you're the wrong one to ask. I'm going to ask Lucas here. There is this reality that as folks in that age category go out and look for new employment, and I've got a few buddies who fit this category, age discrimination is a real thing out there.
It really is, and it shouldn't be, and people get frustrated by it, but it is absolutely a thing. And so it's important to acknowledge it if you're in that age bracket and you're thinking about or you're in the process of searching. It's simply because of the fact that older workers tend to be more expensive for benefits, especially healthcare. Mm-hmm. Employers know that. And there's always this perception about, you know, if you're in your 50s, are you really a short timer here? And I always laugh at that because, you know, a lot of times the employers will also complain about hiring millennials who tend to, you know, be more like free agents and don't stay at places a really long time. And so, the conception that, you know, older worker may not stay a long time makes me laugh. But I do think it's important to be aware of that as a worker and be willing to maybe volunteer some of that information about what your plans are, how long do you want to work, and really showing that excitement for the position that you're looking at.
Well, it's tough to hear. I mean, age discrimination is against the law, Barbara, and yet we're talking here. It's a very real thing, and it's out there every day.
Oh, it is a very real thing. I was thinking about someone I know who had run into it in job interviews, and when he walked in for a tech position, he basically said all the things that the employer couldn't ask. I am this old. I plan to retire at this age. That means I can work for this company for so many years. And now that we have that out of the way, let's discuss what your company and I can do for each other.
Hmm.
And he got the job.
No kidding. It worked for him.
It worked for him.
Good for him.
So I think being very upfront about the fact that you are experienced, that you're looking for a home, someplace you can fit, someplace that you can grow, and someplace that you can advance the company, that's important.
So the theme of today's show is if you have a job here in Kansas City, go ask your job for a raise today. We're going to tip over the whole job culture in Kansas City in one fell swoop. I want to thank my Smart Money team today, Lucas Butchell with Aspire Wealth Partners, Barbara McMahon of Innovest Financial Partners, Nolan Keim with Mariner Wealth Advisors in Overland Park. Thank you all for a good conversation.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is legalized sports betting in the future for Missouri residents. We'll explore the possibility and find out what one neighboring state has gained since legislation. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.